Click on Live Music under Local Events. Now for Weekend.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Social Security will be even more in the spotlight this week as President Trump's nominee for commissioner goes before the Senate. A look at Buy Now, Pay Later offers online. And Amazon is phasing out a privacy feature that limited access to user voice recordings for some of its smart speakers.
It's a shame that this option is going away. Personally, I would have liked to have seen it expanded to more of the devices rather than go away, but it doesn't seem like it's in the roadmap for Amazon's future.
Plus, a new book brings Harriet Tubman into the modern day. It's Sunday, March 23rd. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. This edition of the Up North Report includes details that may be upsetting for some listeners. Around 60 classmates, colleagues, and community members held space and ceremony Friday for the 20th annual Day of Remembrance of the Red Lake High School shooting. Just before class let out on March 21, 2005, a former 16-year-old student at Red Lake High School shot and killed a school security guard, 28-year-old Derek Brune, a teacher, 60-year-old Neva Winecoop Rogers, and five fellow students, Alicia White, Dwayne Lewis, Chase Lusher, Chanel Rosebear, and Thurlene Stelday. Prior to his arrival to the school, the shooter also shot and killed his grandfather, 58-year-old Daryl Lusher, and his grandfather's girlfriend, 31-year-old Michelle Sigena. At the time, the horrific events that unfolded within minutes at Red Lake that day were dubbed the deadliest school shooting since Columbine, and it remains the deadliest school shooting in Minnesota history. Little Rock District Representative Thomas Barrett graduated from Red Lake High School in 2007 and was a sophomore at the time of the shooting. He spoke to the community's closeness during the ceremony at the Red Lake High School gymnasium.
If we're still here, we have honored ourselves in some kind of way. We have honored those we have lost and that we've cared about so much. I was good friends with Chanel and Alicia, and I knew everybody. So that's how we are in our small, tight-knit community here in Red Lake.
Creating a space for healing is a core mission of a small group of the shooting survivors, a few former students who have spearheaded fundraising and organizing for a permanent memorial on the shores of Lower Red Lake. Star Jourdain is an organizer for the 32105 Project. She graduated from Red Lake High School in 2008 and was a freshman at the time of the shooting. Jourdain has worked at the school as a paraprofessional for the last 8 years and gives credit to the students for giving her strength on these days of remembrance.
It was a heavy day, man, and even, you know, being a kid and transitioning 20 years into adult, it got pretty heavy today, but my kids at school, my students kept my spirits high, and they kept me going today.
The 32105 Project was a recent recipient of one of 10 Midwest Memory Grants from the St. Paul-based Forecast Public Arts. According to its webpage, the three-prong grant will release $75,000 for each memorial, $25,000 for capacity building, and $10,000 to pay cultural advisors, plus 80 hours of technical assistance from Forecast Public Arts. With the grant, the 32105 Project is about a quarter of the way to its goal for a permanent memorial on land donated by the Red Lake Tribal Council. Project organizer Raven Roberts says the space is much needed for those impacted.
I just think it's going to be a great place to go heal and just like to bring us all together like every Remembrance Day we have for them.
Missy Dodds was a teacher at Red Lake High School and firsthand witness to the shooting. Currently, works as an advocate for safe and sound schools. The news of the grant brought her some mixed emotions.
When Star called me and told me that they had the grant, and I was so excited. You know, I was like, oh, yay, this is awesome, awesome. And like the next day, I couldn't get out of bed because the memorial will represent that we haven't forgotten the ones that we lost that day, that we're not forgotten. because sometimes it feels that way.
Superintendent of the Red Lake School District, Tim Lutz, was a principal in another district at the time of the shooting, but remembers it being a sobering time for educators across the state. The FBI's investigation into the shooting revealed that dozens of people, including several students, had some prior knowledge of the tragic events that transpired. Lute says a positive school climate is the most important aspect of school safety.
A place where students feel welcomed, cared for, and connected to each other and to the staff. If students feel connected, then they want to be here and they will learn to care for each other. And they will learn to reach out when they see something, go to an adult and say something.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning and thanks for being with us. Congress returns to Capitol Hill this week for a schedule full of hearings on hot button issues, air safety, consumer protections, speech on college campuses, and Social Security. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram joins us now. Hi, Deepa.
Good morning.
So on Tuesday, there will be a confirmation hearing for financial tech businessman Frank Bisignano. He's nominated to be commissioner of Social Security, which is all over the news at the moment. You had Elon Musk calling it a Ponzi scheme at one time, and now some surprising comments from the Commerce Secretary, right?
Right. Yeah, that interview with Secretary Lutnick has really been making the rounds. It was with the All In podcast.
Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She'd think something got messed up, and she'll get it next month.
Yeah.
A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
So Democrats, as you can imagine, have jumped on those comments and said it's reason to believe that the Trump administration will try to roll back Social Security benefits, though Trump has said he will protect Social Security. But at the same time, recent actions and comments from people like Lutnick have really concerned people who rely on and advocate for Social Security benefits. Just a few days ago, there was this whole back and forth where the acting commission of Social Security, Leland Dudek, said he would shut down the agency because a judge ruled that DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, could not access sensitive data from the administration. But then on Friday, Dudek backtracked and said he would not shut down Social Security. And this is all coming as the administration has already announced plans to close some Social Security offices and enact stricter identity checks for benefits that could require in-person visits. So all of that to say, there's a lot going on ahead of the hearing on Tuesday.
I mean, generally, changing Social Security, whether cutting it, increasing the eligibility age, privatizing it, that has not proven to be a political winner in the past.
No. So, you know, Social Security is extremely popular. A Pew study from last year showed that 79% of Americans say Social Security benefits should not be reduced in any way. And think about it. This is a program that's been around since the 1930s that supports millions of retired people, disabled people, and making any changes to it is politically risky. I mentioned earlier how Democrats have been responding to the comments from Secretary Lutnick. They've also been quick to center any comments on Social Security security from Elon Musk, for example, who has made comments inflating how much fraud takes place with Social Security benefits and who recently called the benefit a Ponzi scheme, like you mentioned. But Social Security is such a popular program that there are also Republicans now, like Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, who are speaking out and criticizing Musk's comments.
The Trump administration is ending a program for people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Even as fleeing the regimes in Cuba and Venezuela resonates with Republicans, what did that program do?
So this news came out on Friday. The Department of Homeland Security said it will get rid of legal protections for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. And these are people who have come to the U.S. since October 2022. This order would apply to about 500,000 people from those countries who arrived to the U.S. specifically with permits to live and work here under the Biden administration. So there was a legal pathway for them to be here because the CHNV program was designed to create more legal pathways of immigration. But in about a month, DHS says these people would lose their legal status and will face deportation, or the White House is saying they can self-deport. The order is in line with Trump wanting to crack down on humanitarian parole programs and keep his campaign promise of these mass deportations. But I will say it's possible that the courts get involved in the elimination of CHNV, so that may be something to keep an eye on.
That's NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Deepa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have a green card or a valid visa, entering the U.S. is usually a straightforward affair. Border officials might ask the purpose of your visit and how long you intend to stay before waving you through. But lately, officers have stepped up their questioning of travelers. Visitors with apparently minor visa violations have been shackled and chained and sent to U.S. detention centers. Michelle Hackman, who covers immigration for The Wall Street Journal, has been following these cases. She joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So in your latest article, you mentioned border officials are using aggressive questioning tactics with visa holders and tourists. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of cases, and it's tough, Ayesha, because the government in many cases is unwilling or unable to give us all the facts in the case. But what we're seeing is people with relatively minor visa issues. So let's say they're on a tourist visa and they're house sitting for someone. Another example, someone who's a fiance of a U.S. citizen coming in on a tourist visa and border officials saying, wait a second, that's illegal. You should be on a fiance visa. You know, in the past, border officials would say, okay, there's a problem with your visa. You need to fix it and come back to us. Now people are being sent to detention centers. They're being deported over these really minor violations. And it's scary for people.
Obviously, I'm not a lawyer and not privy to everything that ICE knows. But why not just deport someone who has problems with their visas immediately or just turn them around at the airport? Why shackle and chain them and keep them in ICE detention?
I think some of the issues around shackling and really aggressive questioning that we've seen is in some sense just rogue officers that have fewer checks higher up in the chain. The reasons that people are being detained for much longer, not entirely clear to me, but often if you are going to be deported, it's something as simple as you need to buy a plane ticket, and the government doesn't just let you buy any plane ticket. You have to buy an open plane ticket, which means they can put you on any flight, and those can run, you know, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. People don't often have that money, and so they're being detained longer so they can collect the money just to buy their plane ticket home.
Mm. You've reached out to U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials. What are they telling you?
Yeah, so they are pointing to President Trump's executive order that orders extreme vetting. And they're proud of this. They're saying, you know, we're enforcing the laws on the books and we're catching attempted terrorists coming into the country. We're catching people who are breaking our laws. You know, this is something that they are proud of.
One concern that people have had is border officials going through people's phones and looking for, you know, social media, stuff like that. Is that legal? Is it legal for border officials to go through people's phones?
In our laws and in our precedent, we, even as U.S. citizens, have very few rights at the border. You and I, coming back into the country, could have our phones searched. And that's even more the case for people who are not U.S. citizens. It's totally legal for agents to search people's phones, to search people's social media accounts. They're using AI tools to find things on people. So it's a much deeper level of searching than people are aware of. And I think people are being even more scrutinized than they were just a few years ago because of these really recent advances in AI technology.
Can people be deported just based on their beliefs or say if they just don't like the current administration? Is that enough to get deported just based on that?
That's a really live question, and I think that's the one that we're going to be answering in the courts over the next few years. Obviously, there was a really famous case that's ongoing with this Columbia grad student, Mahmoud Khalil, who participated in pro-Palestine protests, and the government is alleging maybe did more than that, spread Hamas propaganda. And the government's rationale is that it is a foreign policy priority for them to remove him from the country. And on the face of the law, that's legal. You know, whether that law is legal, I think, is going to be the big question that we have to answer. There have been several other cases since where they're trying to apply that same law to other people.
Travelers from Asia, Africa, and South America have a much more difficult time entering the U.S. compared to Europeans. In India, the current wait time just for an appointment for a tourist visa is more than a year. Most Europeans don't even need a visa to come to the U.S. for short stays. Is the focus on these European tourists being blown out of proportion, or?
I think you hear about it again because these are wealthier people who have more savvy about going to the media. You're right that people from generally from poorer countries have a much harder time even getting tourist visas. The denial rate is really high. And so I think a lot of cases people don't have access to the U.S. at all or being stopped sort of at that level. And so we don't even hear about it.
People abroad may think twice before coming to the U.S. if they're hearing these sorts of news stories. What kind of impact could this crackdown have on the U.S. economy?
It could end up being significant. You know, right now, the industry that I've seen that has been the most alarmed, I would say, are universities, research institutions, the type of places that rely a lot on international exchange. They have foreign professors, foreign students. But it could have a much broader impact. You know, tourism is one of our main industries here in the U.S. But if people feel like they could face danger or long detention, it could deter some people from coming here.
That's Michelle Hackman. She covers immigration for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
We contacted the U.S. Customs, Border, and Protection Agency to ask them about charges of aggressive vetting tactics. A CBP assistant commissioner told NPR in an email that the agency has always performed screenings and inspections. Lawful travelers have nothing to fear from these measures, he said, adding, a visa is a privilege, not a right. You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, contact us at 218-326-1234 during business hours. The board's full meeting schedule is available online at kaxe.org. Northwoods Friends of the Arts and Cook presents entries from their annual photo contest, A Shot in the Dark, now through March 28th. The gallery is open Thursday and Friday from 10 to 4 and Saturdays from 9 to 1. University of Minnesota Extension presents Fridays with a Forester, an online series each Friday at 9 a.m., now through the end of April. These informal sessions will feature a different topic each week. To learn more and register, visit z.umn.edu/Fridays 2025. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Police in Las Cruces, New Mexico have two suspects in custody linked to Friday night's mass shooting. Three people were killed and at least 15 injured. Both suspects are charged with murder. Authorities say the shooting happened during an unsanctioned car show at a public park where an altercation between two groups escalated. Wildfires are burning in the Carolinas. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has declared a state of emergency for the Table Rock fire that started Friday in the Blue Ridge Mountains. A fire in western North Carolina led to mandatory evacuations last night. And Conan O'Brien is to be honored tonight with the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. O'Brien will receive the prize at a gala at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsor Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Smart speakers can be a real help in our homes. Baking cookies, Alexa, set a 15-minute timer. Left the game on in the living room, Alexa, turn off the TV. And of course, Alexa, tune in to NPR. You get the point. But how much control do we have over how these devices use our voices? Last week, Amazon announced changes to its Echo devices and plans to disable an optional privacy setting. Jennifer Toohey covers smart homes for The Verge and joins us now to explain. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Before we begin, I want to make a note that Amazon is one of NPR's current financial supporters. Jennifer, can you tell us technically, how do these Echo devices work currently? Like, after you tell Alexa what to do, what happens?
Yeah, so today, the audio of what you said is sent to the cloud and encrypted. And then when it's in the cloud, turned into text, and then the cloud models will figure out what it is that you meant to say, what you want it to do, and then route the request to the right place, send it back to you, and do what you ask, such as turn on a smart home light or ask about the weather.
But tell us about this privacy setting that currently exists and what's changing with that.
On some Echo devices, you did have the option to enable a feature called Do Not Send voice recordings. And that meant it processes your voice locally on your Echo device, then sends that text transcript to the cloud to do everything that we just described. Amazon has said that on March 28th, if you had this setting enabled, it will be disabled and your voice recordings will be sent to the cloud. However, they will be deleted as soon as they've been processed in the cloud.
So why is Amazon making these changes?
They say there are a couple of reasons. The primary one is that this feature was very little used. They're also saying that one of the reasons that they're changing this function is because of their new generative AI-powered Alexa Plus service, which is also launching sometime this month. Because it's generative AI powered, that really needs the extra processing power of the cloud. So whilst they haven't specifically said this is why we're doing this, the implication in their statement is they need the extra processing power of the cloud so that you get a good experience with this new feature that's arriving later this month.
And that new feature will use generative AI. And so presumably maybe it would be able to answer questions better. My kids will ask them, what's the biggest number on earth? And that's like not really a question that can really be answered. And I think Alexa gets confused.
Yes. Well, the new Alexa will probably have a good answer for that. And maybe we'll chat away with your kids for a good half an hour about that problem.
Okay. Okay.
The new Alexa is called Alexa Plus, and it is an entirely new voice assistant that is powered by large language models. on a par of what we're seeing with ChatGPT and Google's Gemini, much more capable assistant that can talk much more conversationally with you. But it is a bit of a shame because there are some privacy concerns around smart speakers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, is there a concern that by them having your voice that they could somehow mimic your voice or someone could get hold of it or something like that? Is that the concern?
Amazon says voice recordings, when they're sent to the cloud, are encrypted. It's secure. You know, when it comes to tech companies protecting your data, Amazon is definitely in a position that have the power and the tools to do so. But ultimately, it comes down to whether you trust the company with your data. And if you're using Alexa devices, that's probably a decision you'd already made. But it's a shame that this option is going away. Personally, I would have liked to have seen it expanded to more of the Echo devices rather than go away. But it doesn't seem like it's in the roadmap for Alexa and Amazon's future.
That's Jennifer Tuohy of The Verge. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
In the flurry of executive orders issued by President Trump, there was one targeting hospitals that provide gender-affirming care for young people. In response, many of the hospitals have stopped or pulled back on certain treatments. That includes Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Kristen Schorsch at member station WBEZ has been tracking the ripple effects on patients and their families.
He's a teenager in the Chicago suburbs. He loves theater and is working on his Eagle Scout project. And he's been receiving treatment for the past 4 years.
Getting this treatment isn't fixing something that's wrong with me. It's just helping me grow more into who I want to be and who I can feel most comfortable existing as.
NPR is not identifying the 17-year-old or his mom because they fear he will be targeted for being transgender. He injects testosterone once a week. He's already frozen his eggs in case he wants to have his own biological kids one day. The next step was scheduling top surgery at Lurie Children's Hospital. But then his mom got a voicemail from the hospital.
And I was like, oh no, I could feel in the pit of my stomach that I like knew what it was.
The surgery was off. Lurie is near downtown Chicago. It is one of the oldest gender care programs in the country. Trump's executive order says that care amounts to chemical and surgical mutilation. It also indicated that if hospitals don't comply, they could lose crucial federal funding. And more than half of Lurie's revenue comes from Medicaid. The hospital's decision left the 17-year-old hurt and confused. He says he had asked his doctors before what they would do if this change came.
All of their responses were, we will fight as hard as we can legally. We will try to push it back as much as we can. And then they go ahead and cancel it themselves. Like, they weren't forced to do that.
Two federal judges have already ruled that the executive order is not enforceable. But Lurie has not resumed surgeries. In Illinois, there's also a state law that says it's illegal to discriminate against patients because of their gender identity. So is Lurie violating that state law? Neither the state's attorney general nor Governor J.B. Pritzker would say. Pritzker, who is a Democrat, did tell NPR he thinks hospitals are being blackmailed into limiting care.
Believe me, I know the people at Lurie Children's Hospital. I know the people who run most of these hospitals. And I can tell you that they want to do the right thing for their patients.
After Lurie's decision, hundreds protested outside.
We're trapped! Kids are under attack! What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
27 states limit or ban gender-affirming care for minors. That includes South Carolina, where Dr. Elizabeth Mack works. She has treated younger trans patients who ended up in the ICU when they couldn't get care.
And they come in either attempting or dying by suicide. It's just one of those things that leaves a mark that I can't unsee.
Lurie has only paused surgeries, not therapy or other treatments. But some parents in Chicago worry about what comes next. Michelle Vallée's son, Ben Garcia, takes testosterone shots every week and gets checkups at Lurie.
There's not a family probably at Lurie that is confident that Lurie isn't going to fold on all of the care. I know you don't have my son's back.
Dr. Robert Garofalo started the gender care program at Lurie Children's. In a statement, he said, quote, "This decision was painstakingly difficult, and it was made amid unprecedented circumstances and external pressures," unquote. He says Lurie stopped surgeries so that they can keep offering the other treatments, like hormones and puberty blockers. Surgery is just one option for minors, and it's rare. Ben Garcia started going to Lurie when he was 10 or 11. Therapists evaluated his mental health over multiple appointments before starting each new treatment. When Garcia was 16, he had a double mastectomy. Without that top surgery, he says,
I would have been more withdrawn, less confident in like myself. This care has allowed me to be a lot more comfortable in who I am and the way that I present myself to the world.
Now Garcia's 18 and headed to college in the fall. Still, his mom and other families feel betrayed by Lurie.
I can have compassion and understanding that it's economic too, right? But at a certain point in the environment we're in, you have to say, no, I'm not doing this.
After Lurie canceled their surgeries, many patients were referred to Northwestern Memorial Hospital. But after booking appointments there, Northwestern canceled those too. For NPR News, I'm Kristen Schorsch in Chicago.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with WBEZ and KFF Health News. Buy now, pay later. That sounds good. But is this financial service right for you? You've likely seen those pay in installment options when paying for something online. They're a form of credit offered by financial technology companies like Klarna, Afterpay, or Affirm that largely work how they sound. They loan you money to buy goods instantly and allow you to pay them back over time. According to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, one in five shoppers has now used BNPL loans to make a purchase. LifeKit's Andy Tagle is here to help us walk through some of the pros and cons. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Aisha.
All right, so these are advertised for everything from furniture to groceries. Before someone clicks on that offer and says, yes, let's do it, what do they need to know?
BNPL loans are a financial tool, so they're not inherently predatory to consumers. You just have to be smart about how and when you use them. And there are a lot of reasons why people really like them. Many loans are interest-free and offer longer repayment plans than the typical 30 days you see with a credit card, making them great to free up your cash flow and break up big or surprise purchases. And there's no long-term commitment usually to a financial institution. So once you pay off your loan, your relationship with that BNPL company is done. But it can be easy for people to get carried away. And one reason why is the lower bar to access. Getting a BNPL loan is super quick and easy. I applied for one for patio furniture, in the name of research, of course, and was approved in about a minute. And all I needed to provide was basic contact info, my birthday, and a form of payment.
Well, that doesn't seem like a lot of information for the company to make the decision off of.
I know. I spoke to Ed DeHaan about this. He's a professor at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and he says these companies use algorithms to analyze available online data about consumers to assess them for risk and approve them for loans. And that's opened up a new credit pathway specifically for young people and people with poor or limited credit history, which can be a double-edged sword.
It's good in that a bunch of people are getting access to credit that didn't have it before. The bad thing is that those characteristics are the same characteristics of people who tend to get into trouble with debt. Because they don't have that experience yet, they tend to overspend and then have trouble paying off their balances, which can lead you into a debt spiral.
So this is where it gets to get kind of dangerous or tricky, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When you break down your shopping cart into small numbers, it can be easy to trick yourself into thinking you have more money than you do. This is according to a 2024 study out of Harvard. So, you know, if you set out to make a $100 purchase, but only have to pay $20 upfront, or maybe nothing at all, depending on the plan you choose, you might feel more liquid than you are. And the other part of this, according to DeHaan, is that BNPL companies create ultra-tailored shopping experiences in their apps because they have access to your browsing and purchasing history. His analogy is, when you go to check out at the grocery store, they have impulse buys lined up, but those have to appeal to a wide audience, right? Gum, magazines, candy bars.
But with BNPL, they put the exact products in front of you that you really want, which makes that impulse purchasing very powerful.
So given that risk and, you know, those impulses at play to get some retail therapy, is there a time when a BNPL loan is a good idea?
Oh, absolutely, Aisha. You know, what DeHaan told me is, as long as you're responsible, these loans carry no more inherent risk than a credit card. They are newer, though, and they work differently than other financial products, so you're going to want to keep some things in mind. First, read the fine print before you sign up. Every BNPL company offers different payment structures, terms, and fees for late or missed payments. If you like using these loans, consider sticking with one BNPL provider. Each loan is on its own payment cycle, so having them all under one roof can make it easier to keep track of all your bills. And you might also think about syncing up those payments with your paydays to avoid any potential overdrafts. And a final note, because it's a common misconception, you're likely not contributing to your credit history when you're repaying these loans. BNPL companies generally don't report to the credit bureaus, so just something to keep in mind.
That's Life Kit reporter Andy Tagle. Thanks so much.
I hope it helps, Ayesha. Happy shopping.
If you want more personal finance tips, check out NPR's Life Kit podcast at npr.org/lifekit. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Days after breaking a ceasefire in Gaza, Israel has also now resumed airstrikes on Lebanon. Lebanese officials say at least 7 people have been killed, including a child. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah militants. Last year, Israeli attacks killed the militant group's leader and caused widespread devastation in the south of the country until a ceasefire was agreed to in November. NPR's Lauren Freyer is covering this story from neighboring Syria and joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ayesha.
So, Lauren, what sparked this round of violence?
Well, it started yesterday when the Israeli military says it intercepted rockets fired from Lebanon. No one was injured. Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group backed by Iran, which is also a political party in Lebanon, it denies firing those rockets. It says it respects the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. But Israel says it's retaliating against Hezbollah anyway. The Israeli military sent out videos of its fighter jets taking off to attack Lebanon, officers huddled around in a command center, black and white footage of what it says are strikes on Hezbollah's weapons and infrastructure. Lebanese officials say civilians have been killed and that more than a dozen areas have been hit across the country's south, but also in the Bekaa Valley, sort of Lebanon's breadbasket, to the east near Syria, where I am, and in the tourist city of Tyre on the Mediterranean coast. One mayor in the south sent NPR video of huge clouds of smoke billowing from his village. There are videos of buildings on fire elsewhere in Lebanon.
Are people in Lebanon now fearing that we'll see a full-scale resumption of the war?
Absolutely. And I think the coming hours and days may tell us whether that happens. Lebanon's national news agency says another Israeli airstrike hit this morning, apparently from a drone that fired on a car near the Israel-Lebanon border. My colleague Jawad Rizallah, NPR's Lebanon producer, has been speaking with a lot of people in southern Lebanon by phone, including a municipal official in a Christian village that suffered damage from shelling last night. That man's name is Maroun Mubarak. And Mr. Mubarak here is saying that some of his neighbors had just repaired their homes from the last Israeli attacks late last year, and now they've been hit again. Church services in his village this Sunday, today, have been canceled. In a few areas, people are even fleeing north again in scenes reminiscent of last fall in Lebanon, when more than 4,000 people were killed by Israeli attacks, according to Lebanese health officials.
What else has Israel been saying about why it's carrying out these strikes?
As in Gaza, Israel says it's targeting Iran-backed militants who have fired at Israel across the border. And as in Gaza, Israel is able to intercept most attacks on its territory and inflict disproportionate damage on the other side. It's worth noting this comes at a time of real tumult inside Israel. There have been big protests over the resumption of the war in Gaza and fears for the lives of the hostages still held there. There's also been unrest over Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's firing of his intelligence chief. And it's worth adding also that this is the deadliest exchange across the Israel-Lebanon border in months, but it is not the first. A lower intensity conflict has continued in southern Lebanon, even during a supposed ceasefire. And a spokesperson for UN peacekeepers in Lebanon tells NPR that that force has tallied 680 cross-border attacks that violate that truce, the vast majority of them by Israel.
That's NPR's Lauren Freyer in Damascus. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE KPXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering rotating taproom exclusive beers and crawlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Thursday, 2 to 9, Friday and Saturday, 11 to 10, and Sunday, 11 to 6. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids hosts AARP Foundation Tax Aid by appointment only now through April 11th. This tax preparation service is free for families and individuals of all ages. There is a meatball dinner to benefit the Begley Senior Center today from 11 to 2 at the Begley American Legion. Live music by Figuring It Out follows at 2 p.m. All proceeds will go towards a new roof for the Senior Center. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Health officials in Gaza say the Palestinian death toll has now climbed past 50,000 since the war with Hamas started more than 17 months ago with the October 7th attack. The latest includes more than 600 killed since Israel resumed its bombardment of Gaza last week. In Turkey, a court formally arrested the mayor of Istanbul today and jailed him pending trial on corruption charges. Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu was detained last week, sparking a wave of street demonstrations. His party is expected to endorse him for president, voting today in a primary election. And Pope Francis is back at the Vatican after spending the past 5 weeks in a hospital in Rome. He was released today, but doctors say he will require at least 2 more months to fully recover from a life-threatening case of pneumonia. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to shorten the gap between cancer research and cancer care. Learn more about Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery at danafarber.org/everywhere. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us this week is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
Excellent. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. A little chilly today, but I'm okay. Would you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, it came from Joseph Young. It was a little tricky, too. I said, name a famous island in 8 letters, remove 3 consecutive letters, and those that remain in left or right order will name where many islands can be found, but not this one. What island is it, and where can't it be found? Well, the island is Atlantis. You take away 3 letters and it cannot be found in an atlas.
Oh, that was kind of tricky because there were just over 560 correct entries. So this fooled some people. And this week's winner is Drew Skinner of Havertown, Pennsylvania. Congratulations, Drew.
Thanks so much, Aisha.
Yeah, so how did you figure that out?
Well, it kind of reminded me of Thursday and Saturday's crossword puzzles where there are tricks being played. I first jumped into the Caribbean, but that didn't work, and so I jumped into the Atlantic, and I figured maybe I should figure this out from a trick angle, and it happened that way.
Oh, wow. How long have you been playing the puzzle?
Since rotary phones.
Okay.
it's like I've been waiting for your call for 20 years by my rotary phone.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So you're not new to this. You're true to this.
Yeah. No, that's a good way of putting it.
And so what do you do when you're not playing the puzzle? You seem to know about crossword puzzles. So would you say that you're an expert?
No.
No. But you enjoy them. That's what's important.
Yeah, I do enjoy them.
Okay. Well, Drew, I gotta ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
Absolutely not. Maybe with your help.
All right, you can do it. Take it away, Will.
All right, Drew, I know you can do this. And Aisha, this is a good two-person puzzle, so feel free to jump in. I'm going to name some things that are in categories, like days of the week or U.S. states, and each one I name is second alphabetically in its category. Your job is to name the one that comes first. For example, if I said 5, you would say 8, because 5 is the second digit alphabetically, and 8 is the only one that comes before it. Here you go. Your first one is August.
Okay.
August is the second month of the year alphabetically. Which one comes first?
It's coming up soon.
Yeah, no, spring. I know. April.
Yes.
April is it?
I got you now.
Good job. Your next one is sight, S-I-G-H-T.
Sight.
What's the only one of the 5 senses that comes before sight?
Hearing.
Hearing, is it? British Columbia.
Canada, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Alberta?
Alberta, good job. Astros.
Astros. A's.
A's is actually the Athletics,
Angels.
So that's...
Angels.
Angels, good job. Columbia. We're looking for Ivy League schools.
Brown.
Brown is it, nice. Antony and Cleopatra.
This one, Aisha, I need help with.
Is it like couples from the...
I gave you a hint, it's a 5-word title, and every word has 4 letters in it.
Oh.
It's another Shakespeare play, and it's a saying?
Yes.
About how things will turn out.
All's well that ends well.
Yes.
That is it, nice. Huron, H-U-R-O-N.
Erie?
Erie is it, nice. And here's your last one. How about Brooklyn?
Brooklyn would be...
boroughs of New York City?
Bronx.
Bronx is it. Good job.
That was tricky. Drew, that was a tricky one. I wish I could have been more helpful. But you did an awesome job. How do you feel?
As everyone says, relieved. I'll do better next week when you call.
Exactly. Keep in there. But you did a wonderful job. For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Drew, what member station do you listen to?
WHYY in Philadelphia.
That's Drew Skinner of Havertown, Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for playing the puzzle.
Thanks so much, guys. Take care.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from listener Dan Asimov of Berkeley, California. In English, the two-letter combination, TH, can be pronounced in 2 different ways. One is in the word booth, and the other is in smooth. What is the only common English word other than smooth that ends in the letters TH as pronounced in smooth? So that's the question. What is the only common English word other than smooth that ends in the letters TH as pronounced in smooth?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, March 27th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we live in an age where technology is doing a pretty good job helping to diagnose diseases. But TikTok, on that app, fun, sometimes quirky videos about mental health are getting millions of views. And for those who wonder if they have adult ADHD, new research shows TikTok is where lots of people are getting their information.
And they arrive at our office telling us they have ADHD, and in fact, quite often now they're telling us the type and the dose of medication they want to treat this.
But TikTokers get the diagnosis wrong 50% of the time. Not great odds if that's your go-to place for mental health information. Learn more tomorrow morning on your radio, online, or the NPR app. You can call Bob the drag queen a lot of things. Performer, musician, comedian, and recently, traitor. Now you can add one more thing to that list: author. Bob's new book is all about one of his idols, Harriet Tubman, who he's called the first Black superhero. In fact, when asked this question on Ziwei Fumado's talk show, who would win in a fight, Harriet Tubman or Spider-Man, Bob did not hesitate.
I'm going to go with Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman is a scout for the U.S. military. The cardio on this woman, from below the Mason-Dixie to Canada 12 times?
Bob the drag queen is here now to talk about his new book, Harriet Tubman, Live in Concert. Welcome to Weekend Edition.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
In your story, you have these larger-than-life historical figures come back to life, including Harriet Tubman. Can you give us a little taste?
Got it. I never thought this day would come. When so many figures from the past started returning, I just kept hoping that Harriet would show. Not only did she show, but she reached out to me. I still have the invite she sent me, a lovely little handwritten note. Get over here, Harriet Tubman, with the address of the studio. I think I'll have it framed.
So, what kind of help does Harriet want from Darnell? And Darnell is your main character.
Harriet Tubman wants to continue her work as an abolitionist. She's interested in freedom. Freedom is her guiding light. And obviously the goalpost for freedom has moved from what it was when Harriet Tubman started her work as a conductor on the Underground Railroad. So she wants to reach a lot of people, and hip-hop is a magnificent form of art that has reached millions of people. So she reaches out to Darnell, who is a former Grammy Award-winning producer, and she wants his help with reaching the masses.
So where did your love of Harriet Tubman come from?
I'm from Atlanta, right? So I know a lot of people will talk about their work in school when they did Black History Month. Well, in Atlanta, we take it very, very seriously. Like, we teach Black history all throughout the year. Well, I just remember every time I learned something new about Harriet Tubman, it sounded unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But yet, tons and tons of historians are able to corroborate all these stories. She did things that seemed otherworldly. I mean, she even had superpowers. She had precognition. She was getting divine insight on where to go, where not to go, what to do, what not to do, in ways of staying safe, and make roughly a dozen trips back and forth without ever getting caught one time, never losing a passenger on the Underground Railroad, is a really big accomplishment. She's possibly the most remarkable person to ever live.
When did you come up with the idea of, like, having historical figures come back to life?
I never had a desire to write a book about people come back to life. I just want to write a book about Harriet Tubman writing a hip-hop album, and then I had to justify it. And I had to justify it.
Yeah.
And it's not sci-fi. When you read the book, you're not going to be going deep into how it happened, you know, the molecular structure of the DNA 4-3 time-space continuum. It's not all that. The book is like, it's happening and it's here. We haven't figured it out yet. It's just happening and we're all just living with it, you know?
So you wanted Harriet Tubman and hip-hop to be mixing a little bit.
Harriet Tubman used music when she did her work as an abolitionist, you know? She actually did use music. So it's actually not that far-fetched to imagine that Harriet Tubman would be using music today if she were actually still here doing things with us.
Well, I mean, a lot of people may not know about Harriet Tubman's military service. I think most people know the Underground Railroad, but there are lots that they don't know. And that's explored in this book. Do you feel like this book is also a way to give a fuller picture of her life and to teach more to those people who may not have listened in history class or may not have been taught in history class about these facts about Harriet Tubman?
So just to give Harriet Tubman her flowers, Harriet Tubman is not just the first woman to lead a U.S. military mission. To date, she is the only woman to have ever done it. My book is not a history book. It takes place right now. You can learn things from it. She was a spy. She was a cook. She was a chef. She was a mother. She was a wife. One of many siblings. She had so many odd and crazy and scary and remarkable things happen in her life. She opened up a home for formerly enslaved people who were reaching an age of retirement, where she ended up living at the end of her life because she actually got scammed by people from her own community, even though she had done everything, she had given every ounce of everything she had to help people. And I think that stuff is really important.
Who do you look at as the audience for this book? I know it's not a history book.
I mean, the truth is I am the target audience for this book. I wrote a book that I would want to read. If you're a theater nerd, if you're a Black queer, if you're a millennial, if you're a history buff, if you like hip-hop music, if you like absurd concepts, this book could be for you.
I got to ask you about your most recent TV appearance on The Traitors. I think we have a clip from that.
I will tell a truth, but I will never tell a lie. All of you know I've never lied. Guys, I said I swear to God. God! And that was a lie, because I don't believe in God. I'm a traitor.
Did you have that speech prepared?
No, I was making it up as I realized I was going home. I had so much adrenaline, I actually misspoke several times. I meant to say I will tell a joke, but I'll never tell a lie. That's what I meant to say. And then at the end, when I said I swear to God, I meant to say that wasn't a lie, because I don't believe in God. That's what I meant to say, but I just had so much adrenaline coursing through my veins that it just came out wrong. But the idea got across.
The idea, it definitely got across. It all worked out. For your fans who got to know you on Traitors and then before that on RuPaul's Drag Race, what should they expect when they get to this book? It's another side of you. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, it's not a memoir, y'all. It's not about my life. I'm not in this book. It's not stories of me and RuPaul or me at the club and the drag queens come in and we doing shots and we're voguing. That's not what this book is. I mean, it has to do with me because I'm a Black American. And I do want people to know that it does show a different side of me.
The book is called Harriet Tubman Live in Concert. There are songs in the book. Would you sing a little bit of one of the songs for us?
For sure. Harriet says, I think it's time to write some good music. I mean some hood music. I'm talking about, I wish some wood music liberated my people through the swamps and the dirts and the wood music. Never would have made it if I never had the vision, but the Holy Spirit said I could music.
Oh my goodness. I love it. I love it. Now, I gotta ask you, when you think about Harriet Tubman, you're thinking about freedom. What is freedom to you?
I have a couple of quotes that I really love. One that I use is Kris Kristofferson, and he says, you know, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And I love when Nina Simone said, freedom means no fear. I mean, really, no fear. I love those definitions of freedom. And am I completely free? No, I have fear. Living in our current administration, I have fear. You know, living in this world, I have fear. Fear of financial insecurity, fear of what's going to happen with my career, fear of what people think of me, fear of what's going to happen with these laws as I see actions against people of color and people who are disabled and queer people, specifically trans people. That does give me a lot of fear, actually.
But the thing about fear, though, that I always think about is that you can be afraid, but you keep going. And that's really Harriet Tubman, right?
Oh, yeah. Keep going. No matter what, keep going.
That's Bob the Drag Queen. His new book is Harriet Tubman, Live in Concert. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. To everyone listening, Shantae, you stay. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and music from around the world on KAXE 7 days a week. Friends and community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. The Brainerd Public Schools Legendary Women Hall of Fame will induct a new class Thursday, March 27th at the Geechee Zibi Center for the Arts. A social gathering begins at 4:30, and the ceremony begins at 5 p.m. Project Read is accepting gently used children's books at the Community Education Service Center in the former Southwest Elementary Building in Grand Rapids. Northland Arboretum is offering a tour of the maple syruping operation at Clay Hill Farm near Brainerd on Saturday, March 29th at either 9 a.m. or 1 p.m. Pre-registration required at Northland.com.